Focus Beats. Or try a new podcast, play Desert Island Discs. And of course, if you want to listen to live radio, you can just say play Radio 3. Music, radio and podcasts available on most smart speakers. Just say open BBC Sounds to get started.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's midday and time for Private Passions. And Michael Barclay's guest is the archaeologist and historian Simon Thurley.
At the age of seven, Simon Thurley dug up what turned out to be Roman remains in his back garden in Cambridgeshire, and a lifelong passion for history and historic buildings was ignited. He went on to work as curator of historic royal palaces and as the director of the Museum of London. Then, in 2002, at the astonishingly young age of 39, he was appointed chief executive of English Heritage, a post he held for 13 years, during which time he was responsible for overseeing over 400 historic sites from Dover Castle to Stonehenge. He's the author of more than a dozen books about history and architecture, and since 2021, he's chaired the National Heritage Memorial Fund, the fund of last resort to protect the nation's most vulnerable heritage when other routes have failed. Simon, I must ask you first, I think, about digging up those Roman remains when you were a little boy. What were they and what happened next?
Well, I was inspired by a really remarkable character, a man who was an archaeologist, an architect, a historian, Michael Green. His name was sadly no longer with us. And he'd been digging up bits of Godmanchester, our village, for many, many years and discovering Roman remains. And I'd been lucky enough to wash pots on the spoil heap for him and then got permission from my parents to dig a hole in our garden. And one thing led to the other. And eventually we triggered a full-scale excavation on our lawn where a Roman basilica was excavated.
Your neighbours must have thought there was some terrific forensic examination going on there. People's gardens are dug up.
Well, it was more my father who was a bit upset that it was no good for playing tennis or croquet on anymore.
Now, you've chosen music by Purcell, Handel, Gluck, Bellini, all with historical connections that resonate with you, I think. Let's start with Puccini's much-loved aria from Tosca, E lucevan le stelle. I think we can all agree that the music is powerful, wonderful, but perhaps you can fill us in on the historical background to the opera.
Well, I do love it. It's got everything that a good opera, in fact, a good story ought to have. It's got the most marvellous baddie you can ever imagine. I mean, Scarpia is so wicked and horrible. And, of course, it's got a beautiful woman and it's got a sort of political exile and an artist. So it's all there. But it is actually, as you rightly say, it's set in a marvellous bit of Napoleonic history. It's set in Rome in 1800. And it's an opera I've seen, I don't know, more than a dozen times. And I find it the most extraordinary marriage of music and a story which, you know, it's just about believable.
Mi cadea
Rolando Villazon with that aria from the third act of Puccini's Tosca. Marcello Viotti was conducting the Munich Radio Orchestra. Simon Thurley, you dedicated your book about Tudor palaces, houses of power, to your mother, who you say gave you your love of history. And I wonder if you were steeped in history even before you made your amazing Roman discovery in the back garden.
Yeah, well, my parents were both, particularly my mother, both my parents were very keen on visiting country houses and National Trust houses. I had a membership of the, life membership of the National Trust when I was 15, and we always visited churches and cathedrals. And for some reason, it didn't sort of trigger a rebellion in me, as some it does in some children. It just cemented a real fascination. I mean, not so much about sort of stylistic issues, but about how these buildings were used in the past and how people lived in them.
And was there a degree of religion in your upbringing?
Oh, yes, a lot of that. We were brought up in a very sort of pious, God-fearing family. We went to Sunday school on Sunday afternoon after having been to church on Sunday morning. So there was a lot of that. It was a Baptist church, and I was actually baptized as a teenager by total immersion.
Did you enjoy the religious side of things, or did you fight against it?
No, I eventually fought against it, rather, and I came back to it later in life.
But you sang quite a lot of hymns, presumably.
A lot of hymns. Huge numbers of lusty Baptist hymns, which, actually I still continue to love.
Yeah. You've chosen an extraordinary hymn. I'm so pleased you've chosen part of Holst's The Hymn of Jesus, because I think it's a masterpiece, actually. We don't often hear it. Derived from plain chant, heard first instrumentally and then chorally.
It's taken up as a hymn much beloved of Anglo-Catholics, which is where I ended up, actually, in my own sort of, religious journey. Mm. It is hauntingly, hauntingly beautiful. And, of course, it's written right in the middle of the First World War. And I suspect part of the sort of haunting flavour of it is caused by all the sort of horrors that Holst was presumably reading in the newspapers, because he didn't fight in it, back at home.
Thank you.
Mark Elder conducting the Halle Orchestra and Youth Choir in the prelude from The Hymn of Jesus by Gustav Holst. Very early in your career, Simon, you worked on the restoration of Hampton Court after the devastating fire in March 1986. One person died and the fire caused millions of pounds of damage. How did the team you were working with set about restoration? It must have been a huge and daunting project.
It was, and it was the sort of first of, a series of terrible fires that happened, you know, followed by Windsor Castle and Upark. And I think that I was part of the team that was responsible for sort of inventing a methodology of really how to do it. And for the first couple of years I was involved, I had a marvellous title. I was Assistant Inspector of Ancient Monuments. And I knew nothing, and it must have been incredibly irritating for the architectural team who were all very experienced, that this very young chap with his shiny new PhD was to come in and sort of tell them what to do. But eventually what happened was that there was a bit of a vacuum and no one really was quite sure what to do with it all when we built it back. And I came up with a sort of plan for turning the rooms back to the way they were when they were first built in 1700. And that was eventually adopted, and then I became responsible for implementing it.
Hampton Court, however, is the connection, I think, for our next music, because part of the palace affected by the fire there was built by William and Mary, and you've asked for music by the composer who is probably most associated with them, Henry Purcell.
Yes, it is, and he and his music came out of the Royal Court. And this is really the beginning of my study of royal houses, residences, parks, gardens, and the court itself. And you know, Purcell was in the Chapel Royal. He trained in the Chapel Royal. He was in charge of it eventually, and the music came from there. But the piece I've chosen is not a sacred piece at all. In fact, it's what I would describe as a sort of 17th century musical, written in the 1690s, King Arthur, which it's not really an opera. I think the closest you could look at it today is as being a musical, really.
Yeah. I think the thing about Purcell, too, is he was the most extraordinary setter of words. And, in fact, Benjamin Britten really used him as a model for word setting. So it is, again, interesting how history gives building blocks for future architects, future composers, future painters.
Yes, and I think Holst also was very influenced by Purcell, so there's a nice connection there too.
Thank you.
Fairest Isle from Purcell's King Arthur. Paul McCreesh conducting, and the soloist was Carolyn Sampson with the Gabrielli Consort. Music which kind of speaks of grace, doesn't it, in eloquence?
Yes, it does. I think it's intensely beautiful. But, of course, the piece also contains these very rumbustious bits as well, which are really quite funny. And because it's all in English and you can, you know, I don't have any Italian, so I know what they're saying in an Italian opera, but you can hear it all. And I think that's really wonderful.
And the contrast, of course, is what makes it so great. I mean, music which is eloquent, like we've just heard, and those more rumbustious moments.
Yes.
Simon Thurley, much of your career has been bound up with royal houses, and I was startled to read in your book about the buildings of Tudor England that at his death Henry VIII owned more than 70 residences.
Yes, he did. And of course, a lot of them were acquired because of the dissolution of the monasteries, for two reasons. First of all, the sheer amount of money. I mean, he was the wealthiest king to sit on the English throne since probably Edward III. And so he had a lot of money so he could build. But also he just appropriated lots of former monastic houses, lots of episcopal houses. Of course, famously, he got all Wolsey's houses, including Hampton Court, which we were just talking about. Yeah. And yes, he was... well, he was a megalomaniac, I think, really.
He couldn't possibly have lived in them all, but...
No, and of course he gave his successors a huge headache because there was no way when the monastic wealth had all dried up that either Edward VI or Elizabeth could have maintained them. And so they're slowly given away. Some of them actually just were abandoned and literally fell down.
Of course, a lot of the great houses of this country were handed to people as sort of thank yous, weren't they, by the monarchy, either for work as a soldier or just for supporting them.
Yes, I think, and indeed, some of those 70 royal houses were, in fact, given away by, particularly by Elizabeth I, and then following her, James I, who gave away lots. Yes, and it was quite a nice reward to have, a big estate.
He spent, Henry VIII, the equivalent of, I think, about £120 million on Hampton Court, and £50 million building the nearby fantastical Nonsuch. Tell me about that.
Well, Nonsuch, I think, was probably built for his son. I mean, you know, the whole story of his reign is this sort of desperate search for an heir. And when eventually Edward VI, who's a lovely, lovely lad, you know, healthy, fit, clever, bright, comes along, he builds Nonsuch. It's very close to Hampton Court, which at the end of his reign was Henry VIII's principal residence. And the famous stuccos, which were sort of relief panels, which were put all over this building, were a sort of education for him, really. There were the heads of the Roman emperors and the prophets and the liberal arts, and you can almost imagine Henry VIII standing in the courtyard pointing and saying, you know, is that Julius Caesar or, you know, is that Hadrian?
Yeah, yeah. You've seen the designs for this.
Well, the designs don't actually exist, but there are some watercolours. But most importantly, there was an excavation. Out of the ground came large numbers of these bits of stucco, which were all stuck together.
Yes, because it was demolished only about 130 years later, wasn't it?
Yes, it was given to Lady Castlemaine, one of Charles II's mistresses, and she literally just crunched it up for building materials.
Several royal palaces today, Hampton Court or Tower of London, for example, are no longer occupied by the royal family. But looking at the remaining royal palaces, how do you think the use of these buildings might develop under King Charles III?
Well, of course, that's a very interesting question. The Crown has its own personal residences, and the late Queen and the King have Sandringham House, which is quite near where I live in Norfolk, and Balmoral. And, of course, famously, he has his own house at Highgrove, and presumably they'll, you know, continue to be part of the private estate. The monarchy has, as any head of state, has a requirement for large buildings, part of which are just the sort of magnificence of power, if you like, but also just as a requirement for entertainment and hosting receptions. And you need space to do that. And so I think Buckingham Palace, you know, will continue to be used, and Windsor as they have, and actually Holyrood House, very importantly, which is used for a lot of receptions.
I think at the moment he and the Queen Consort go to bed in Clarence House, and then he's got Buckingham Palace more as the office.
Well, Buckingham Palace, of course, is being completely rewired at the moment, so it's a lot of it's a building site. So I think it would be quite difficult to live there. But St James's, of which Clarence House is part, was built by Henry VIII to be the home of the heir to the monarch. It's rather nice that the king, while he was Prince of Wales, actually lived at St James's. There's an incredible historic continuity there.
King Charles has requested a slimmed-down coronation in June, but I suspect that we both hope the next piece of music, Handel's Zadok the Priest, won't be cut from the service. But why have you chosen it for your service today?
Well, first of all, I think it's quite unlikely it'll be cut because at least the words go right back to the 900s. It's, you know, 1,000 years of those words have been used in the coronation and various people have set it to music. The one that we all now know, because actually I think it's probably the only one that really endures and is any good, is Handel's setting of Zadok the Priest, which puts the words from the Bible to music in obviously a completely spectacular way. It is a wonderful coup de théâtre, really, the whole thing. And of course, a coronation is all about theatre. And that's why I suspect that ever since the coronation of George II, it has endured as the bit that everybody knows and everybody anticipates.
God save the king, long live.
Trevor Pinnock conducting the English Consort and the Westminster Abbey Choir in Handel's coronation anthem, Zadok the Priest. You can find details of all my guests today, Simon Thurley's music, if you go to the Private Passions website, and if you search for the programme in BBC Sounds, you can find hundreds of previous editions to download and enjoy at your leisure. Simon, when you were at English Heritage, I imagine you had to grow quite a thick skin. How did you cope with the inevitable criticism, the inevitable demands that come with the job? For example, the outcry about the chaos surrounding the opening of the new visitor centre at Stonehenge.
It was a tricky job, it has to be said, because there were always two sides to everything we did. There were people who would say, this is outrageous that you haven't protected this and kept this building standing, and there were people who would say exactly the opposite. So you kind of could never please everybody. And Stonehenge, of course, was the most difficult of all, because, and it remains the most difficult of all, because although in my time we managed to close the A344 and rejoin the grass over the road so that the stones began to get back into a setting, there is still the case of the A303, which remains an intensely controversial issue. And whilst I'm very firmly on the side of putting it into a tunnel, there are many, or there are certainly some, who think it's a monstrous destruction of the World Heritage Site. So it will always be, and it always has been, very controversial.
But if you put it into a tunnel, surely it will be preserving the site.
Oh, well, I'm very keen for putting the road into a tunnel, because people say to me, or used to say to me, when we drive past, we love looking at the stones. And what I would always say, well, when we're standing in the stones, we don't look like particularly looking at you driving past, because it should be this incredibly tranquil, actually, I would say, spiritual experience, connecting with the stones. And a big tailback of juggernauts slightly detracts from that.
In the autumn, a campaign group mounted a vigorous attempt to win seats on the National Trust Council, angry about a so-called woke takeover of the Trust, and particularly critical of the foregrounding of the role of the slave trade in generating the money to build some of our best-loved country houses. I wonder how you deal with this in your mind, about how we should present our history.
Well, as a historian, I'm in a way absolutely delighted that people have woken up to something which all of us as historians make our living from, which is that history is complicated and difficult, and there are lots of different ways of looking at it. And I think that the whole, if you like, woke, to use the phrase you've just used, approach to things has opened up a new way of considering history. It's not, when I say it's new to most people. When I was at English Heritage, we had a conference on slavery in the country house, 20 years ago. So it's not something that's perhaps new to people who are doing it professionally. But I think it is interesting for the general public to consider history from different perspectives, and I don't have a problem with that.
There's probably not a right or a wrong answer to, for example, statues of slave traders.
Well, I think that the government has got this little phrase, which is retain and explain, and I think it's absolutely spot on, actually, which is that if you go around looking for things in people's past that you don't like, there are going to be very, very few statues that remain, because slave trading wasn't the only thing that in the past I think we would find difficult. People who voted against votes for women, where does that leave us?
Well, music next from Mascagni's one-act opera Cavalleria Rusticana, a dramatic tale of love, jealousy and revenge set in a 19th-century Sicilian village. I'm rather pleased to hear that you've chosen this, but not the piece that we most often have. I think this is something you've got to know quite recently, though.
Actually, it is. And as a consequence, there isn't an elaborate backstory here. We tend to listen to classical music in the mornings. So you can't cope with anything heavier. As the day goes on, it sort of develops. And I've taken to listening to this, you know, quite often in the mornings. And it's a lovely, beautiful, soothing piece.
Thank you.
Music from Cavalleria Rusticana by Mascagni, Riccardo Muti, conducting the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and Chorus in a new recording released late last year. You mentioned Norfolk, so where do you live in Norfolk?
We live in an ancient merchant's house in King's Lynn on the waterfront.
And when you say we, with another historian, your wife.
Yes, my wife Anna Kay is also a historian of the sort of 17th century, but she also she's the director of the Landmark Trust, which is another heritage body. So I'm afraid we're a bit of a sort of heritage group up there.
Actually, King's Lynn is quite an interesting historical place, isn't it?
Yes, it is an interesting place. I mean, it's not a Roman or Saxon town. It was actually founded in 1100 by the Bishop of Norwich to be a trading centre, and our house is one of the very, very early houses that was built there, and the earliest bits date from about 1220, so it's been around for a long time.
Living in a listed building can be a joy, but can also be difficult. They're difficult to heat, insulate, need a lot of repair, planning consents for making any changes. How can we make it easier for people to live in more financially and environmentally sustainable ways in old houses, do you think? So they continue to be loved and maintained.
Well, I think that the energy arguments are really, really interesting. One of the most, I think, powerful arguments for retaining and living in old buildings is you don't have to knock things down and build things out of glass and steel, creating a lot of carbon. So the question is how do you make your old house more efficient? And we have to remember that until the 1960s, I mean, the name of the game was conserving energy. And it was only the profligacy of the sort of post-war era that led to people having thin windows with no shutters and curtains and the heat billowing out. So, you know, a lot of very old houses like the one we live in have got shutters and we have thick curtains. And although we don't have double glazing, actually the effects... We tested this out at English Heritage. The effects of shutters and curtains are exactly the same as having double glazing. So it's a question, I think, actually partially of changing the way you live in an old house. And, of course, there are things you can do. You can put insulation in the roof and things.
Well, your next music takes us to the Stuart dynasty. I suspect you feel that our obsession with the Tudors somewhat unfairly overshadows that equally fascinating family, the Stuarts.
Yes, my most recent book, Palaces of Revolution, is really about the Stuart century and about, I think, obviously there's a momentous moment of the Reformation, but the Civil War and then what followed and led to what we call the Glorious Revolution in 1688 are equally momentous. And the connections with buildings and the places in which these things happened are very, very intense. And my next piece of music, I think, is perhaps for some people rather an obscure opera, which is essentially written about the Roundheads and Cavaliers. It's a 19th century French opera, actually, and fascinating that they were so interested in the English Revolution, so-called, at that point.
This is I Puritani.
Yes.
Music by Bellini.
Yes, and it's a sort of Romeo and Juliet set in the Civil War with a Roundhead falling in love with a Cavalier and it all getting very mixed up and all the usual shenanigans of mistaken identity, which all comes out all right in the end.
Yes, it's the final scene you've chosen where Cromwell pardons all the prisoners.
That's right, and there's great joy and happiness and the lovers get together.
quite right that Joan Sutherland should have the final say.
Wow, yes, that was fantastic, wasn't it? She sounded very, very happy to be reunited.
The finale of Bellini's opera I Puritani, in the recording with Joan Sutherland and Luciano Pavarotti, and what would have made her even happier was that her husband Richard Bonning was conducting the chorus of the Royal Opera House and the London Symphony Orchestra. Simon, we've talked about Tudors, Stuarts, William and Mary, so listeners might be surprised to know that when you were at English Heritage, you championed the listing of post-war buildings.
Yes, I absolutely did, and I think it was an important moment for us because the sort of generation after the generation who's built something, you know, look back at it and think, what a terrible, awful mistake. And, you know, I think there were some terrible, awful mistakes made in the post-war era, but there were also buildings of brilliance and actually sublimity that were created. And we oversaw a really quite difficult and controversial process of identifying which of the post-war buildings, particularly some of the brutalist structures. It was quite difficult because the politicians found it quite uncomfortable. And I remember going up with an arts minister to Preston bus station. Now, you won't know this building, but it's a brutalist megastructure. It is really a very remarkable building. And I remember the minister looking at it and saying, "You must be joking." And getting back into the ministerial car. Mm. She may be listening, so she'll remember that. She'll remember that moment.
But do you think, as in music, that we do require sometimes the passage of time to see that what we perceived as ugly and brutal, as you say, can have its own sort of beauty? I mean, I can think of contemporary music where one might make that analogy.
Yes, I think that's absolutely spot on. And that's why our job was so difficult, because we had to take ourselves out of now and put ourselves in 50 years' time and look back towards the present. And trying to make those sorts of judgments is very difficult. And, you know, I'm sure we got it right quite a lot, but I'm absolutely certain that there are buildings that went, which people in the future will say, you know, why on earth, for a famous one, the brutalist building is the old Birmingham Library, an inverted concrete pyramid. I mean, really rather a remarkable building, which in the end wasn't listed. People may look back and say, you know, what a loss, but we don't know.
Well, finally, Simon, one of your very favourite pieces. It's music from Gluck's Orfei et Euridice. Why do you love this quite so much?
Well, it's funny because it's one that I first came across when I bought an LP of sort of opera highlights. And it wasn't this piece. It was I Lost My Eurydice, which is the piece that was on that album, which is, I think, the best known aria perhaps in this opera. And it encouraged me to go out and actually buy the full LP, as it was in those days, and listen to it. This is when I was 20. And it really was the first conscious piece of music that I went out and bought myself and really appreciated. And it's remained a favourite, and I listen to it a lot, and I think it's so beautiful.
Well, it only remains for me, Simon Thurley, to thank you very much for sharing your passion for music, architecture and history.
It's a pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you. Barbara Hendricks in that aria from the second act of Orpheus and Eurydice by Gluck, with John Elliott Gardiner conducting the Monteverdi Choir and the orchestra of the Lyon Opera. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, Simon Thurley. The episode was produced by Jane Greenwood, and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. And you can find details of all today's music if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds, where you can also download hundreds of previous editions. And Private Passions returns next Sunday at noon, when Michael's guest will be the novelist Susie Boyd. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds and on most smart speakers. Just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock and time for the news, read by me, Jane Royce. Labour says Richard Sharp's position as chairman of the BBC is increasingly untenable after a report by MPs found he had not given them the full facts about his appointment. The Digital Culture, Media and Sport Committee said Mr Sharp had made a significant error of judgment by helping Boris Johnson secure a loan facility while he was Prime Minister. Mr Sharp insists he's done nothing wrong. The Foreign Office Minister Andrew Mitchell says the government could lift sanctions on Syria if they're holding up aid after last week's earthquakes. More than 28,000 people are now confirmed to have died in Turkey and Syria. The Disasters Emergency Committee says its appeal has raised more than £60 million. The Wagner mercenary group says its fighters have captured a village near the Ukrainian city of Bakhmut. The region has been the centre of months of bitter fighting. The head of the International Olympic Committee, Thomas Bach, says that while he shares the grief of Ukrainians, governments shouldn't decide who takes part in sporting events. Kyiv wants a boycott of the Paris Olympics if Russian athletes are allowed to compete. A man's been charged with violent disorder and assault after a protest outside a hotel housing asylum seekers in Merseyside. 19-year-old Jared Skeet will appear in court tomorrow. Police say an officer and two members of the public were injured during the demonstration on Friday. US fighter jets have shot down an unidentified flying object over North America for the second time in 2 days. Canadian officials say the craft, which was flying over the northwest of the country, was brought down because it posed a risk to civilian air traffic. The last survivor of the massacre at Oradour-sur-Glane in the Second World War has died. Robert Ebrard was 97. Soldiers from the German SS killed 643 people in the French village days after the Allies landed in Normandy in June 1944. The 18-year-old Mr. Ebrard survived despite being hit by 3 bullets, and he dedicated the rest of his life to telling the story of the massacre. And today's weather, it'll be a mostly dry afternoon with clouds clearing from northern and western parts of the UK, but it will stay overcast in the southeast. And there'll be highs of 11 degrees Celsius in Belfast and 10 in London, Cardiff and Edinburgh. And that's the BBC News. It's 1:02.
I'm Richard Egar, and I'm a conductor, director, and perhaps best known as a harpsichord player. For a complete music addict, it's perhaps surprising that I chose a seemingly totally unmusical instrument. Like a computer, a harpsichord note is either on, bing, or off. But in a new series, I'm going to share my passion for the harpsichord, beginning with its infancy, taking you through its golden age, and ending with its